Turn in your Bibles, please, to Mark, the 10th chapter, verses 35, beginning. Mark, chapter 10. Place your finger in there and let me introduce the lesson tonight. How do you go about killing a college? Well, it's easy. You kill a college the same way you kill a marriage, or a business firm, or a church, or a nation. But somebody asked me, well, is that a biblical topic that you're going to be speaking on? And I say, yes, sir, absolutely it is. In Matthew, the 12th chapter, Jesus said, no house divided against itself can stand. And every kingdom divided against itself, he said, will fall. But you say, that doesn't say anything about a college. He's talking about houses and kingdoms. Well, I know he is specifically there. And yet he's talking about just simply entities that depend upon unity. He says if you want to destroy an entity that depends upon unity for its identity, then just bring in division and it will destroy it. And that's true whether it be a college or a home or a church or a nation. It just doesn't matter. But the text that I want us to look at tonight deals specifically with a college. In Mark, the 10th chapter, verses 35 through 45, he is speaking specifically of a college. And there in that incident is a specific event that was an attempt to destroy that college. Now, the attempt was made from within, but most attempts that are made against things that are good, if they were to destroy, or if they would destroy those good things, those attempts would have to be made from within. I don't think that it's very easy to destroy something good from without. You'll have to destroy it from within if you would destroy it at all. And the attempt here recorded is not intentional. These men were not intentionally attempting to destroy that college. It was being destroyed by default. Of course, the college that I refer to, and I'm going to take the liberty to use this expression tonight, the college that I refer to was the College of the Apostles. That's not a biblical expression. It is, however, one that is currently used in religious circles to refer to the band of disciples that followed Jesus wherever he went. It was a transient college. It was a college that was movable, a college that was not anchored, but one that had its campus wherever Jesus went. And it's called today in religious circles the Campus of the Apostle or the College of the Apostles. Now, the attempt that was made by the apostles themselves. And in this particular context and in this expression of this incident, Jesus brings his disciples together and gives them instruction on how to save a college. And it's in that light that I speak to us tonight, and then I want to make some applications for our benefit. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to him and said to him, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And he said to them, What do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. But Jesus said to them, You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or to be baptized with the baptism with which I'm baptized? And they said to him, We're able. Jesus said to them, The cup that I drink, you will drink. And the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left hand is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it's been prepared. And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And so Jesus called them to him and said to them, You know that those who are supposed to rule over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man also came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Let's notice just for a moment the background and the context of this strange incident. You see, Jesus and these men had been going around together for about 3 years, over 3 years. These men had been accompanying Jesus
and had seen all of his life and heard his teachings. And in this constant daily association with him, they had seen his contempt or his disregard for things. On one occasion, Luke records in the 9th chapter, they were on their way up to Jerusalem. And a man came up to Jesus and said, Teacher, I'll follow you wherever you go. Jesus, reading this man's motives, said, The birds of the air have nests, the foxes have holes, but the Son of Man has not where to lay his head. And on other occasions, he gave this indication that he just didn't care for things of the earth. Physical things didn't hold much importance to him. And he said, A man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of things that he possesses. They saw that. They also saw what Mark records in Mark, the 3rd chapter, verses 20 and 21. When Mark records where Jesus was healing the people outside his home or outside where he was staying. And it says that there were so many people coming and going that he didn't even have time to eat. And someone told his friends this. And they went out and seized him, laid hold on him. They said, he's beside himself. He's lost his mind. You know, he's beside himself. So they saw his attitude toward things. They also saw his attitude toward people. Jesus couldn't care less whether he had things, but he could care very much whether there were people around him. And so he gave his life in this one channel toward people and disregarded his life in the other channel toward things. And these men had caught somewhat of a glimpse of what he had in mind, because they also had caught a glimpse and had gotten their priorities arranged right in regard to things on this very occasion. When they left Perea, or the part of the country across the Jordan, no, it wasn't across the Jordan, it was up north of Jerusalem, but it was on this side of the Jordan. When they left there, the last 2 weeks of his life, and came up through Jericho and on up toward Jerusalem, there was a man that ran to Jesus and said, Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus told him, Well, keep the commandments. And he said, Which ones? And he told him certain ones that he should keep as examples of the whole. And he says, I've done all of these from my youth up. And Jesus, it says, looked upon him and loved him. And he said, One thing you lack. If you would be perfect, go and sell what you have and give it to the poor and come follow me, and you'll have treasures in heaven. This man, it says, turned away sorrowfully because he had great possessions. But then in contrast to that, just on down in verse 28, that was in verse 22, at that saying, his countenance fell, and he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. But then after that, Jesus said, You know, it's difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And his disciples said, Well, Lord, who can be saved then? And he said, Well, with God, all things are possible. And then Simon Peter makes a statement that does truly represent their attitude toward things. Peter said, Lord, we've left everything and followed you. And he was referring to their forsaking their occupation. They were forsaking what they had done, their means of livelihood, and had come to follow Jesus Christ and put their trust in him. They had come to do that. They were not like the rich young ruler. The rich young ruler turned back to his things and kept the things and denied Jesus. These men, Simon Peter says, had left all these things, denied them, and had come to follow Jesus. They had made that decision. But you know what they couldn't make? They were not able, once they had made that decision and had forsaken all those things and cut themselves off from what you might call the outside world of livelihood, having made that adjustment and then having banded themselves together, they were not able to make this adjustment toward themselves in their personal relationships with each other. And I find this, and I wanted to mention it later, but I find that it's so typical of people who band together for a cause. It's so easy, having separated ourselves from things that are external forces and having made the adjustment of excluding ourselves from things that are outside the realm that we want to live in. Having done that, how difficult it is to get our personal relationships with each other squared away to where we really and truly let that attitude of self-denial carry over into our personal relationships. Now, that's where they made their mistake. It was on this occasion, and this text indicates it, James and John, having already given up their fishing industry, having already been very self-sacrificing in that respect, came into this little band of disciples, and lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, before you could drop a hat, here they were asking Jesus to let them sit one on the right hand and one on the left.
Well, James,
John,
where is your self-sacrificing
attitude? Oh, well, they had forgotten about that. How many marriages have been formed by a man and a woman who each has renounced all other relationships? They've denied themselves. They've sacrificed everything else in order to be with this woman or be with this man. And having made that adjustment of things outside this relationship, they come together and then fight like cats and dogs. Well, where is your attitude of self-sacrifice that caused you to forsake all others and come together? Oh. Or what church finds itself filled with people who have renounced the outside world, who've cut themselves off from things that are sinful, who have shown a degree of self-sacrifice in that respect, and yet when they come together, instead of letting that attitude of self-sacrifice carry over into their personal relationships, it seems that we forget what it's all about, and we leave that attitude of self-sacrifice out there, and we fight like cats and dogs among ourselves as brethren. Well, that's what was happening here. And neither did they learn from this incident. Later on, we find in Luke, the 22nd chapter, they were still scrambling for position. They were still asking for places of superiority. And they were mumbling over there even at the supper, at the Last Supper, in the context of Jesus giving his own life. In that context, we still find them mumbling toward one another and saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom? And Jesus said, what were you all talking about? And they wouldn't tell him, and I should think not. They were embarrassed, at least they were embarrassed about it, but they were still doing it. So we find that this was what occupied these people at this particular time, and neither did they get over it later. They were still involved, even up to the last night that Jesus was living on the earth. Now, the immediate context, all of this that I'm talking about, where they, though they had said, we renounced everything, we're going to follow you, but now we want you to do something for us, they still were grappling for positions of power and were wanting to be on the right hand and on the left hand of Jesus. All of this took place in the context of Jesus' own statement to them that he was going to have to go up to Jerusalem and die. Listen, in verse 32, just before James and John came to him and said, we want you to do something for us, in verse 32, he makes this statement, and they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they'll condemn him to death and will deliver him to the Gentiles, and they'll mock him and spit upon him and scourge him and kill him. Yeah, Lord. Okay, all right, I understand. Now look, John and I've got something we want to talk to you about. Are you through with that? Yes, I'm through. Well, listen, will you? What is it you want? Come on, John, let's ask him. And John's mother was in there too saying, yeah, come on, our boy's got something we want to talk to you about. What is it? Well, we want to sit one on your right hand and one on your left when you come in your glory. Well, didn't you hear just what I got through saying? What did you say? And Luke says that they couldn't grasp what he said. Luke records this same event in Luke, the 18th chapter, and Jesus makes this statement there, but it says it was hid from them. They couldn't grasp what he said. And I think that their actions here indicate they never did see what he was talking about. Why is it that we're like that? Jesus' whole life was centered around this concept of dying in order to give life to this body of men. Dying in order to give life to that college. He was the founder. His whole life was characterized by self-sacrifice. And he felt there was no cost that was too much, even to the point of shedding his own blood, in order to infuse life into this little band of disciples, into this little college of the apostles. But they couldn't see that. They didn't understand. And there came this action and then this reaction. What was the action? The action by James and John was born out of ignorance. Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. That means that they were ignorant of what their petition was. You don't know what you're asking. It was born out of ignorance. It was nourished out of absolute arrogance. He said, well, are you able to drink the cup that I'm going to drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism I'm going to be baptized with? They said, yep, we're able. Jesus said, well, all right, you may. In fact, he said, you will. You'll drink it and you'll be baptized with it. But to give you the right hand or left hand position in my kingdom is not me, it's not mine to give. It's for the one for whom it's been prepared. And then watch the reaction. Boy, it says the other 10 were indignant. Indignant. There isn't a stronger word than this expression here. They began to be indignant against the other two. What a reaction. But it's as natural as night following day or day following night. You know where indignation starts? It starts here, this little hole in your chest, right there. Have you ever been indignant against somebody? It doesn't start in your hand. You don't even feel it in your head. It affects you right in here. And you begin to have this terrible pain and this cramping inside your chest as you look at somebody who's stuck his foot in his mouth and who's gotten ahead of you and had the audacity to ask what you were wanting to ask yourself. And this imbecile, you know, got up there first and got the note in to the president first and got that position. And then when the person gets set back, boy, here it comes. They began to be indignant against these two brethren. Indignation always stops communication. Indignation always breeds alienation. And just as surely as any group of people, whether it be a college or a home or a church or a nation, anytime a group of people comes to the place where certain ones are trying to get the edge over others and think that they have the right to have a special position, it always creates indignation. And then you can just watch the chain reaction, just like pushing dominoes over. One thing will trip another. There'll be indignation, and then alienation, and then coolness, and then complete separation, and then animosity. And then you've got this little college of men that Jesus was talking about here. You've got them on the verge of being broken up and destroyed. Well, so Jesus called a meeting of the staff. He called what you would call a faculty, I guess, a faculty meeting. And he sent out a notice that, come here, I want to talk with you. And he stood up in this faculty meeting and said, now, look, you know that those that rule over the Gentiles lord it over these people, and they exercise authority over them. And he simply referred to what's done in the state institutions. The positions in state, he said, are filled by men who lord it over people. They love these big places of importance. But he said, that's not going to be the way my people run the show. It's not going to be like that. He said, among you, the one that would be greatest must be your servant. And he that would be most important of all, he must be your one who comes last. He that would be first must come last. And so he just simply sets the tone and says, now, if you want to follow me, you're going to have to follow me on my plan and with my plan and follow me on my basis. You can't operate on another basis. The people of the Gentiles do it a different way. We're not going to act like that. If you're going to follow Jesus, he says, if you're going to follow me, he that would be great among you must be your servant. He that would be first among you must be last. And then watch what he does. He gives himself as an example. He says, for the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, that's the college of the apostles. May I make an application here? And I'm going to make an application that is not the prime application necessarily, except as numbers. We're in our 53rd year, the college here at Harding. And I want to make that application, not at the expense of those of us who are resident members who are not a part of the college, but I'm going to do it like the woman who sent her little boy to school. And she sent a note along with him the first day and said, Johnny's a very sensitive child. If he misbehaves, just slap the child next to him. He'll get the message. So the obvious, outstanding example sitting right in the midst of us of a college, and we'll just use that, would be Harding College. And may I just draw some conclusions that will perhaps help us apply this to our lives in general. This school is in its 53rd year, not in its third year, as Jesus College was. And we're familiar with the spirit of self-sacrifice that characterized those people who were the founders of this school. I want to read some passages out of the book For Freedom by L.C. Sears, and then I want to tell you a statement or two by Brother Croom, and I want to show you there was so much self-sacrifice on the part of these people who were the founders of this school. For one thing, there was a debt, an indebtedness of $6,186.15 that had to be liquidated and had to be eliminated. Mrs. Armstrong assumed the burden of remodeling the dormitory. With the help of an expert builder, she moved partitions to enlarge rooms. She made closets, arranged baths. The cost, even with some volunteer labor, was over $1,600, and this she paid personally over several years from the tuition of her private students in speech. This seems a small sum now, but according to the Consumer Index, it would be equivalent to $5,500 in 1967. Brother Sears says that since Mrs. Armstrong's income was a fourth of the average for that time, it was for her equivalent to a gift of $22,000 now, but that was in 1967. I wonder what it would be today. Maybe $32,000. Well, other people. Liquidating the large debt was the major problem. Students and teachers helped. And this was something that they all got together with, and they did it as a voluntary job or a voluntary effort and a joint effort among themselves. One brother wrote and said, "We're not compelled to have very much, only about $650, but this we must have or quit." The desperation of such an appeal involving such a paltry sum shows how hard it must have been in those drought years for Armstrong to raise over $6,000. Finally, as a last extreme, the faculty agreed to sell 40 student scholarships to apply on the debt. This, in effect, meant that the teachers themselves were making the final payment, for the money from tuition covered by the scholarships should have come to payment of salaries. The scholarships sold at once, but because of a sudden slump in the cotton market of the world at the outbreak of World War I, 7 scholarships were canceled. S.A. Bell was sent into the field to sell 7 more. By the fall of 1915, the debt was paid and the property was free. Salaries of teachers and other operating expenses were a constant problem. Until Batzel Baxter came to be dean in 1916, no teacher received more than $35 a month, and for only 9 months. Baxter, who had rejected an offer of $2,000 from a church, received $50 a month. Married teachers with salaries had to supplement their incomes by preaching on Sundays and holding meetings through the summer. A roommate of mine, says Brother Sears, who worked in a bank, once saw a check for $105 marked salary, which Armstrong had written to W.T. Vaughan at the opening of the school year. "You know, Armstrong has been lying about the salaries he pays the teachers," this person declared. "I saw Vaughan's check. He gets $105. Brother Sears says there must be some mistake. "I know Armstrong is no liar. I'll ask him about it." And I went to him the next day. "Yes," Brother Armstrong said, "I gave Vaughan a check for $105, but that was salary for the last 3 months of last year. I was unable to pay all the salaries at the close, and he said he could wait till school opened." Brother Croom says that in those beginning years over in Marlton, that it was such a strain on him and upon others, such as S.A. Bell and B.F. Rhodes, that it was unimaginable. He didn't know any way to describe it. He said himself, he said, "I don't like to talk about it," but he said, I would go to bed at night and wake up crying in the middle of the night and not know why. Brother Croom served as president for 2 years. And he said, "I would wake up crying and my wife would say, 'What's the matter with you?' He said, 'I don't know.' He said, 'Well, why are you crying?' He said, 'I don't know, but I can't stop and I can't help it.'" And he came as near, he said, as he's ever come to a nervous breakdown. We're familiar with all of these things. And you know what? Those of us who have followed and watched the steps and watched the lives of those people who sacrificed so completely selflessly, we have also, and I'm going to say we, though I'm not a part of it, but it's easier to speak about it in that way, we've also learned somewhat of this sacrificial spirit as it comes to things. Because there's not a teacher here, probably, who could not double his salary were he to go to a state school. Now, if I'm wrong in that, Ray, isn't that right? You could double your salary, give or take a few $25 or $30. Give or take that much, you could double your salary by going to any state school to teach. And yet you've made it known that you want to be a part of Christian education. And so you've come here. A woman told me the other night as we were talking in one of the life session groups, she said, "I came here because I wanted to have a part with Christian education." She said, "I'm making somewhat less or more than or less than $4,000 less than I would have made had I stayed there. $4,000 a year loss in salary. But," she said, "I wanted to be a part of Christian education." So we've learned that, and we've said, like the apostle said, "We've forsaken everything and we've come to follow you." We've forsaken everything, you could say, and we've come to be a part of Christian education. But you know what? Once having done that, the most threatening situation that comes to you is having made that connection, or having made that disconnection with the world, to where you've done like the apostles, they've disowned all this. Having done that, then come together in a band such as we have here, one of the most difficult things to do is to have that spirit of self-sacrifice carry over into our personal relationships as they exist here on campus among teachers and faculty and students. And all of this, you see, it's so difficult to make it carry over into our personal relationships. And I don't care whether it's students, whatever it may be, or faculty, or staff, in the sense of administration, it's awfully difficult to maintain this spirit of self-sacrifice among ourselves. And you know what the immediate context of this need is this. There are private colleges closing all over this United States by the dozens every year because they just can't make it. And you know why they won't make it unless they learn the secret that Jesus taught here. And then there comes this action and reaction among us if we're not careful. The action, well, whenever anyone in whatever association it may be, whenever anyone insists on a special place or special privileges, or asking as they ask Jesus, let us have the right hand and the left hand, let us have the places of prominence, whenever anybody does that, whether they be students or whatever, individuals or departments, faculty, staff, or student body, which simply can be defined as self-seeking or selfishness, whenever that happens, you can count on it, there's going to be a reaction in the opposite direction by those people who are not in on it and are not in on your request. I remember when I was in school as a student, I think really for a while there, if everyone had followed my example, David Lipscomb College would have been killed, because I was too immature to see that you can't just take from something, you've got to give. You can't go in there and expect to have special privileges and to do your own thing, you know, and hang everybody else. If everybody did that, where would you be? And if everybody acted like, if senior students, for example, act in the sense that, or in the way that disregards freshman students, and seniors, you know, look at the freshmen and look at them like they're dogs and make the freshmen serve them and make the freshmen do this, that's going to kill a college. You can't operate like that. Or if teachers who have a long standing and a long tenure, if they look to the college as being, as owing them something, you know, as owing them something special, and every person then begins to have a special vendetta himself to where he looks out for himself and himself alone, or if his department is that which comes first, and if he simply says, we're going to ask for special privileges, we're going to ask that we have this and this, why? Well, because we feel like that we deserve this kind of an... Well, that's exactly what James and John said. And I'll tell you, wherever it exists, it'll kill whatever it's a part of, whether it's a college or a home or a church or a nation. And it was this to which President Kennedy addressed himself when he said, don't ask what the country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And that's not just a very smooth, well-sounding phrase. He was referring to this same principle here. Jesus talked about it. And we must also consider it, or else reaction will set in. And that reaction is indignation. And then whenever enough people start thinking that they have a special cause, look, everybody has a special cause. Every department has a special cause. Everyone feels like they have a right to flaunt the rules. Everyone feels like they have a right to not be troubled with things that the Constitution of this college demands that be set as standards. There are people who think, well, you know, I don't have anything to do with that. You take care of that. That's not my business. If everybody were to think that, of course, the college would go down the drain. If every student were to think that, the college would go down the drain. If you want to kill a college, just do your own thing. Insist on being like James and John. Insist on special privileges, special position, and let everybody else, you know, take the hind part. You're going to look out for number one. That'll kill a college as soon as anything else will. Cleavage, alienation, coolness, and then we'll get to be farther and farther apart. And what began 53 years ago as a well-knit, tightly organized, fanatical group depending upon each other and associating only with each other in the sense that they were absolutely bound with a death bond, we'll either do this or die together. That which began like that begins to drift away, cracks begin to appear, and what started out as a tightly knit group begins to be alienated and fragmented and begins to die. So Jesus must call again a faculty, staff, and student meeting. At the beginning of every year, he needs to call this meeting and say, now look, you know the way that state colleges operate. You know they strike and they go on and they all look out for number one and they don't really care what the others get or do. But he said, that's not going to be the way it is with you. He that would be greatest among you must be your servant, and whoever be first among you must be slave of all. And then he'll say to us, as he says to those people back there, Look, the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And so to all of us, he gives this lesson. We must call a meeting, perhaps, of our family. How many of us are having trouble in our families? We better call a meeting. Or perhaps in our businesses. How many of us are having trouble in our firms, our business firms? We may need to call a meeting of all of the employees. How many of us are having trouble in the church? We may need to call a meeting of the whole church. And listen to Jesus as he says, now look, the people that live in the world act like this. They're always practicing one-upmanship. They're always looking out for number one. They're always doing their own thing, but that's not going to be the way it is with you. Those of you who follow me, you'll have to realize that if you want to be the greatest, you're going to have to become the slave of everybody. And if you're going to be the first, you're going to have to lay down your life and give up yourself if you're going to serve and follow me. And you're going to have to make this answer to this question. Do I want what I'm a part of to live? If you do, if we want what we're a part of to live, whether it be a college or a home or the church or our business, do you know what the key to it is? If you want that institution to live of which you're a part, you'll have to go there as a dead man. We'll all have to die to ourselves and renounce this way of John and James' action toward the other disciples and toward Jesus. We can't go there with their attitude and have the college or our homes or the church or our business prosper. They will not prosper. It'll kill them as dead as a doornail. I wonder if we're really, if we see it. You see, I don't think we're any better off than the apostles were. They saw it in Jesus. They saw this self-sacrificing spirit. They saw and heard him say, now I've got to go and give my life up. They heard him say, I'm laying down my life. Nobody's taking it away from me. They heard him say that I must go up to Jerusalem and be killed there and be raised the third day. They heard all of that. They saw his attitude toward people. They saw his attitude toward things. They saw how self-sacrificing he was. But they never did get the principle. They never did get the point. I wonder how many of us have ever gotten the point. This is the Spirit of Christ. This is the mind of Jesus. If you would like to be a part of something that's alive, you're going to have to go there as a dead man. And that's the very point of being a Christian anyway. Jesus says, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Now, that's just a general principle. And when a person who is a Christian does that, and when a person who becomes a Christian, he will do that. Otherwise, we haven't become Christians until we're willing to take up our cross, deny ourselves, and follow Jesus. And when that person does that, then if he's a part of a college, that college will live because of him. If he's a part of a family, that family will live because of him. If he's a part of the church, that church will live because of him or her. If he's a part of a nation, that nation will live because of that person. For only those people who die possess the power to cause something else to live. How do you kill a college? Well, it's easy. You kill it just like you kill a family or a church or a business or a nation. You kill it by failing and refusing to deny yourself, by refusing to give up yourself in service to other people. God bless us and help us. Oh, I would love to get this principle incorporated into my own life. I see in myself that I haven't learned this principle yet. I wish I could say that I had, but I haven't. And I see it sticking up like a sore thumb in my own personality. And I have to work on it daily to even halfway come toward doing it. May I urge you, listen to this statement that Jesus made. Listen to this faculty meeting that Jesus conducted. And then look at his example, and then follow it, and everything you're a part of will live. This campus will just thrive, and nothing can shut you down. Your home will thrive, and nothing will shut you down. This church will thrive, and nothing will shut us down. But it only comes when the church or the school or your home is composed of people who've died to themselves. May God bless us. Let's band ourselves together now. Let's look at the example of our leader, and then let's incorporate that into ourselves as followers. You can't kill a group like that. It's going to live from now on out to eternity if those that make it up are dead people, dead to the world and dead to themselves. May God bless us. Listen to these things and take them home with you and do some thinking about them. And let's see if we can't put them into practice in our lives and be blessed from it. We're going to sing a song of invitation. Ray, what's the name of it? Jesus calls us. Would you listen to this invitation by Jesus, and let's commit ourselves to him right now while we stand and sing.